Razis, Montagnana, Mime, you will all follow me, ye professors of Paris, Montpellier, Germany, Cologne, and Vienna, and all ye that dwell on the Rhine and the Danube, ye that inhabit the isles of the sea, and ye also, Italians, Dalmatians, Athenians, Arabians, Jews, ye will all follow my doctrines, for I am the monarch of medicine. But he did not long enjoy the esteem of the good citizens of Basel. It is said that he indulged in wine so freely as not unfrequently to be seen in the streets in a state of intoxication. This was ruinous for a physician, and his good fame decreased rapidly. His ill fame increased in still greater proportion, especially when he assumed the airs of a sorcerer. He boasted of the legions of spirits at his command, and of one especially, which he kept imprisoned in the hilt of his sword. Veterus, who lived 27 months in his service, relates that he often threatened to invoke a whole army of demons and show him the great authority which he could exercise over them. He let it be believed that the spirit in his sword had custody of the elixir of life, by means of which he could make anyone live to be as old as the antediluvians. He also boasted that he had a spirit at his command, called Azoth, whom he kept imprisoned in a jewel, and in many of the old portraits he is represented with a jewel inscribed with the word Azoth in his hand. If a sober prophet has little honor in his own country, a drunken one has still less. Paracelsus found it at last convenient to quit Basel and establish himself at Strasbourg. The immediate cause of this change of residence was as follows. A citizen lay at the point of death and was given over by all the physicians of the town. As a last resort, Paracelsus was called in, to whom the sick man promised a magnificent recompense if by his means he were cured. Paracelsus gave him 2 small pills, which the man took and rapidly recovered. When he was quite well, Paracelsus sent for his fee. But the citizen had no great opinion of the value of a cure which had been so speedily effected. He had no notion of paying a handful of gold for 2 pills, although they had saved his life, and he refused to pay more than the usual fee for a single visit. Paracelsus brought an action against him and lost it. This result so exasperated him that he left Basel in high dudgeon. He resumed his wandering life and traveled in Germany and Hungary, supporting himself as he went on the credulity and infatuation of all classes of society. He cast nativities, told fortunes, aided those who had money to throw away upon the experiment to find the philosopher's stone, prescribed remedies for cows and pigs, and aided in the recovery of stolen goods. After residing successfully at Nuremberg, Augsburg, Vienna, and Mindelheim, he retired in the year 1541 to Salzburg, and died in a state of abject poverty in the hospital of that town. If this strange charlatan found hundreds of admirers during his life, he found thousands after his death. A sect of Paracelsists sprang up in France and Germany to perpetuate the extravagant doctrines of their founder upon all the sciences and upon alchemy in particular. The chief leaders were Bodenstein and Dornius. The following is a summary of his doctrine founded upon the supposed existence of the philosopher's stone. It is worth preserving from its very absurdity, and is altogether unparalleled in the history of philosophy. First of all, he maintained that the contemplation of the perfection of the deity sufficed to procure all wisdom and knowledge, that the Bible was the key to the theory of all diseases, and that it was necessary to search into the apocalypse to know the signification of magic medicine. The man who blindly obeyed the will of God and who succeeded in identifying himself with the celestial intelligences possessed the philosopher's stone. He could cure all diseases and prolong life to as many centuries as he pleased, it being by the very same means that Adam and the antediluvian patriarchs prolonged theirs. Life was an emanation from the stars. The sun governed the heart and the moon the brain. Jupiter governed the liver, Saturn the gall, Mercury the lungs, Mars the bile, and Venus the loins. In the stomach of every human being there dwelt a demon or intelligence that was a sort of alchemist in his way, and mixed in their due proportions in his crucible the various elements that were sent into that grand laboratory, the belly. See the article Paracelsus by the learned Renaudin in the Biographie Universelle. He was proud of the title of magician and boasted that he kept up a regular correspondence with Galen from hell, and that he often summoned Avicenna from the same regions to dispute with him on the false notions he had promulgated respecting alchemy, and especially regarding potable gold and the elixir of life. He imagined that gold could cure ossification of the heart, and in fact all diseases, if it were gold which had been transmuted from an inferior metal by means of the philosopher's stone, and if it were applied under certain conjunctions of the planets. The mere list of the works in which he advances these frantic imaginings, which he called a doctrine, would occupy several pages. George Agricola. This alchemist was born in the province of Misnia in 1494. His real name was Bauer, meaning a husbandman, which, in accordance with the common fashion of his age, he Latinized into Agricola. From his early youth, he delighted in the visions of the Hermetic science. Ere he was 16, he longed for the great elixir which was to make him live for 700 years, and for the stone which was to procure him wealth to cheer him in his multiplicity of days. He published a small treatise upon the subject at Cologne in 1531, which obtained him the patronage of the celebrated Maurice, Duke of Saxony. After practicing for some years as a physician at Joachimstal in Bohemia, he was employed by Maurice as superintendent of the silver mines of Chemnitz. He led a happy life among the miners, making various experiments in alchemy while deep in the bowels of the earth. He acquired a great knowledge of metals and gradually got rid of his extravagant notions about the philosopher's stone. The miners had no faith in alchemy, and they converted him to their way of thinking, not only in that but in other respects. From their legends, he became firmly convinced that the bowels of the earth were inhabited by good and evil spirits, and that fire damp and other explosions sprang from no other causes than the mischievous propensities of the latter. He died in the year 1555, leaving behind him the reputation of a very able and intelligent man. Denis Zacquer. Autobiography, written by a wise man who was once a fool, is not only the most instructive, but the most delightful of reading. Denis Zacquer, an alchemist of the 16th century, has performed this task and left a record of his folly and infatuation in pursuit of the philosopher's stone, which well repays perusal. He was born in the year 1510 of an ancient family in Guienne, and was early sent to the University of Bordeaux, under the care of a tutor to direct his studies. Unfortunately, his tutor was a searcher for the grand elixir and soon rendered his pupil as mad as himself upon the subject. With this introduction, we will allow Denis Zacquer to speak for himself and continue his narrative in his own words. "I received from home," says he, "the sum of 200 crowns for the expenses of myself and master, but before the end of the year all our money went away in the smoke of our furnaces. My master, at the same time, died of a fever brought on by the parching heat of our laboratory, from which he seldom or never stirred, and which was scarcely less hot than the arsenal of Venice. His death was the more unfortunate for me, as my parents took the opportunity of reducing my allowance, and sending me only sufficient for my board and lodging, instead of the sum I required to continue my operations in alchemy. To meet this difficulty and get out of leading strings, I returned home at the age of 25 and mortgaged part of my property for 400 crowns. This sum was necessary to perform an operation of the science which had been communicated to me by an Italian at Toulouse, and who, as he said, had proved its efficacy. I retained this man in my service that we might see the end of the experiment. I then, by means of strong distillations, tried to calcinate gold and silver, but all my labor was in vain. The weight of the gold I drew out of my furnace was diminished by 1/2 since I put it in, and my 400 crowns were very soon reduced to 230. I gave 20 of these to my Italian in order that he might travel to Milan, where the author of the receipt resided, and ask him the explanation of some passages which we thought obscure. I remained at Toulouse all the winter in the hope of his return, but I might have remained there till this day if I had waited for him, for I never saw his face again. In the succeeding summer there was a great plague, which forced me to quit the town. I did not, however, lose sight of my work. I went to Cahors, where I remained 6 months, and made the acquaintance of an old man who was commonly known to the people as the philosopher, a name which, in country places, is often bestowed upon people whose only merit is that they are less ignorant than their neighbors. I showed him my collection of alchemical receipts, and asked his opinion upon them. He picked out 10 or 12 of them, merely saying that they were better than the others. When the plague ceased, I returned to Toulouse and recommenced my experiments in search of the stone. I worked to such effect that my 400 crowns were reduced to 170. That I might continue my work on a safer method, I made acquaintance in 1537 with a certain abbé who resided in the neighborhood. He was smitten with the same mania as myself and told me that one of his friends, who had followed to Rome in the retinue of the Cardinal d'Armagnac, had sent him from that city a new receipt which could not fail to transmute iron and copper, but which would cost 200 crowns. I provided half this money, and the abbé the rest, and we began to operate at our joint expense. As we required spirits of wine for our experiment, I bought a tun of excellent vin de Gaillac. I extracted the spirit and rectified it several times. We took a quantity of this, into which we put 4 marks of silver and 1 of gold that had been undergoing the process of calcination for a month. We put this mixture cleverly into a sort of horn-shaped vessel, with another to serve as a retort, and placed the whole apparatus upon our furnace to produce congelation. This experiment lasted a year, but not to remain idle, we amused ourselves with many other less important operations. We drew quite as much profit from these as from our great work. The whole of the year 1537 passed over without producing any change whatever. In fact, we might have waited till doomsday for the congelation of our spirits of wine. However, we made a projection with it upon some heated quicksilver, but all was in vain. Judge of our chagrin, especially that of the abbé, who had already boasted to all the monks of his monastery that they had only to bring the large pump which stood in a corner of the cloister, and he would convert it into gold. But this ill luck did not prevent us from persevering. I once more mortgaged my paternal lands for 400 crowns, the whole of which I determined to devote to a renewal of my search for the great secret. The abbé contributed the same sum. And with these 800 crowns I proceeded to Paris, a city more abounding with alchemists than any other in the world, resolved never to leave it until I had either found the philosopher's stone or spent all my money. This journey gave the greatest offense to all my relations and friends, who, imagining that I was fitted to be a great lawyer, were anxious that I should establish myself in that profession. For the sake of quietness, I pretended at last that such was my object. After traveling for 15 days, I arrived in Paris on the 9th of January, 1539. I remained for a month almost unknown, but I had no sooner begun to frequent the amateurs of the science, and visited the shops of the furnace makers, than I had the acquaintance of more than 100 operative alchemists, each of whom had a different theory and a different mode of working. Some of them preferred cementation, others sought the universal alkahest or dissolvent, and some of them boasted the great efficacy of the essence of emery. Some of them endeavored to extract mercury from other metals to fix it afterwards, and in order that each of us should be thoroughly acquainted with the proceedings of the others, we agreed to meet somewhere every night and report progress. We met sometimes at the house of one and sometimes in the garret of another, not only on weekdays but on Sundays and the great festivals of the church. Ah, one used to say, if I had the means of recommencing this experiment, I should do something. Yes, said another, if my crucible had not cracked, I should have succeeded before now. While a third exclaimed with a sigh, if I had but had a round copper vessel of sufficient strength, I would have fixed mercury with silver. There was not one among them who had not some excuse for his failure. But I was deaf to all their speeches. I did not want to part with my money to any of them, remembering how often I had been the dupe of such promises. A Greek at last presented himself, and with him I worked a long time uselessly upon nails made of cinnabar or vermilion. I was also acquainted with a foreign gentleman newly arrived in Paris, and often accompanied him to the shops of the goldsmiths to sell pieces of gold and silver, the produce, as he said, of his experiments. I stuck closely to him for a long time in the hope that he would impart his secret. He refused for a long time, but acceded at last on my earnest entreaty, and I found that it was nothing more than an ingenious trick. I did not fail to inform my friend the Abbé, whom I had left at Toulouse, of all my adventures, and sent him, among other matters, a relation of the trick by which this gentleman pretended to turn lead into gold. The Abbé still imagined that I should succeed at last, and advised me to remain another year in Paris, where I had made so good a beginning. I remained there 3 years, but notwithstanding all my efforts, I had no more success than I had had elsewhere. I had just got to the end of my money when I received a letter from the Abbé telling me to leave everything and join him immediately at Toulouse. I went accordingly and found that he had received letters from the King of Navarre, grandfather of Henry IV. This prince was a great lover of philosophy, full of curiosity, and had written to the Abbé that I should visit him at Pau, and that he would give me 3,000 or 4,000 crowns if I would communicate the secret I had learned from the foreign gentleman. The Abbé's ears were so tickled with the 4,000 crowns that he let me have no peace night or day until he had fairly seen me on the road to Pau. I arrived at that place in the month of May 1542. I worked away and succeeded according to the receipt I had obtained. When I had finished to the satisfaction of the king, he gave me the reward that I expected. Although he was willing enough to do me further service, he was dissuaded from it by the lords of his court, even by many of those who had been most anxious that I should come. He sent me then about my business, with many thanks, saying that if there was anything in his kingdom which he could give me, such as the produce of confiscations or the like, he should be most happy. I thought I might stay long enough for these prospective confiscations and never get them at last, and I therefore determined to go back to my friend the Abbé. I learned that, on the road between Pau and Toulouse, there resided a monk who was very skillful in all matters of natural philosophy. On my return, I paid him a visit. He pitied me very much and advised me with much warmth and kindness of expression not to amuse myself any longer with such experiments as these, which were all false and sophistical, but that I should read the good books of the old philosophers, where I might not only find the true matter of the science of alchemy, but learn also the exact order of operations which ought to be followed. I very much approved of this wise advice, but before I acted upon it, I went back to my Abbé of Toulouse to give him an account of the 800 crowns which we had had in common, and at the same time share with him such reward as I had received from the King of Navarre. If he was little satisfied with the relation of my adventures since our first separation, he appeared still less satisfied when I told him I had formed a resolution to renounce the search for the Philosopher's Stone. The reason was that he thought me a good artist. Of our 800 crowns, there remained but 176. When I quitted the Abbé, I went to my own house with the intention of remaining there till I had read all the old philosophers, and of then proceeding to Paris. I arrived in Paris on the day after All Saints of the year 1546, and devoted another year to the assiduous study of great authors. Among others, the Turba Philosophorum of the good Trevisan, The Remonstrance of Nature to the Wandering Alchemist by Jean de Meung, and several others of the best books. But as I had no right principles, I did not well know what course to follow. At last I left my solitude, not to see my former acquaintances, the adepts and operators, but to frequent the society of true philosophers. Among them I fell into still greater uncertainties, being, in fact, completely bewildered by the variety of operations which they showed me. Spurred on, nevertheless, by a sort of frenzy or inspiration, I threw myself into the works of Raymond Lully and of Arnold de Villeneuve. The reading of these and the reflections I made upon them occupied me for another year, when I finally determined on the course I should adopt. I was obliged to wait, however, until I had mortgaged another very considerable portion of my patrimony. This business was not settled until the beginning of Lent, 1549, when I commenced my operations. I laid in a stock of all that was necessary and began to work the day after Easter. It was not, however, without some disquietude and opposition from my friends who came about me, one asking me what I was going to do and whether I had not already spent money enough upon such follies. Another assured me that if I bought so much charcoal I should strengthen the suspicion already existing that I was a coiner of base money. Another advised me to purchase some place in the magistracy, as I was already a doctor of laws. My relations spoke in terms still more annoying to me, and even threatened that if I continued to make such a fool of myself, they would send a posse of police officers into my house and break all my furnaces and crucibles into atoms. I was wearied almost to death by this continued persecution, but I found comfort in my work and in the progress of my experiment, to which I was very attentive and which went on bravely from day to day. About this time there was a dreadful plague in Paris, which interrupted all intercourse between man and man and left me as much to myself as I could desire. I soon had the satisfaction to remark the progress and succession of the three colors, which, according to the philosophers, always prognosticate the approaching perfection of the work. I observed them distinctly, one after the other, and the next year, being Easter Sunday, 1550, I made the great trial. Some common quicksilver, which I put into a small crucible on the fire, was, in less than an hour, converted into very good gold. You may judge how great was my joy, but I took care not to boast of it. I returned thanks to God for the favor he had shown me, and prayed that I might only be permitted to make such use of it as would redound to his glory. On the following day I went towards Toulouse to find the abbé, in accordance with a mutual promise, that we should communicate our discoveries to each other. On my way I called in to see the sage monk who had assisted me with his counsels, but I had the sorrow to learn that they were both dead. After this I would not return to my own home, but retired to another place to await one of my relations whom I had left in charge of my estate. I gave him orders to sell all that belonged to me, as well movable as immovable, to pay my debts with the proceeds, and divide all the rest among those in any way related to me who might stand in need of it, in order that they might enjoy some share of the good fortune which had befallen me. There was a great deal of talk in the neighborhood about my precipitate retreat, the wisest of my acquaintance imagining that, broken down and ruined by my mad expenses, I sold my little remaining property that I might go and hide my shame in distant countries. My relative, already spoken of, rejoined me on the 1st of July, after having performed all the business I had entrusted him with. We took our departure together to seek a land of liberty. We first retired to Lausanne, in Switzerland, when, after remaining there for some time, we resolved to pass the remainder of our days in some of the most celebrated cities of Germany, living quietly and without splendor. Thus ends the story of Denis Zachaire, as written by himself. He has not been so candid at its conclusion as at its commencement, and has left the world in doubt as to his real motives for pretending that he had discovered the philosopher's stone. It seems probable that the sentence he puts into the mouths of his wisest acquaintances was the true reason of his retreat, that he was, in fact, reduced to poverty and hid his shame in foreign countries. Nothing further is known of his life, and his real name has never yet been discovered. He wrote a work on alchemy entitled The True Natural Philosophy of Metals. Dr. Dee and Edward Kelly. John Dee and Edward Kelly claimed to be mentioned together, having been so long associated in the same pursuits and undergone so many strange vicissitudes in each other's society. Dee was altogether a wonderful man, and had he lived in an age when folly and superstition were less rife, he would, with the same powers which he enjoyed, have left behind him a bright and enduring reputation. He was born in London in the year 1527, and very early manifested a love for study. At the age of 15, he was sent to Cambridge, and delighted so much in his books that he passed regularly 18 hours every day among them. Of the other 6, he devoted 4 to sleep and 2 for refreshment. Such intense application did not injure his health, and could not fail to make him one of the first scholars of his time. Unfortunately, however, he quitted the mathematics and the pursuits of true philosophy to indulge in the unprofitable reveries of the occult sciences. He studied alchemy, astrology, and magic, and thereby rendered himself obnoxious to the authorities at Cambridge. To avoid persecution, he was at last obliged to retire to the University of Louvain, the rumors of sorcery that were current respecting him rendering his longer stay in England not altogether without danger. He found at Louvain many kindred spirits who had known Cornelius Agrippa while he resided among them, and by whom he was constantly entertained with the wondrous deeds of that great master of the hermetic mysteries. From their conversation he received much encouragement to continue the search for the philosopher's stone, which soon began to occupy nearly all his thoughts. He did not long remain on the continent, but returned to England in 1551, being at that time in the 24th year of his age. By the influence of his friend Sir John Cheke, he was kindly received at the court of King Edward VI, and rewarded, it is difficult to say for what, with a pension of 100 crowns. He continued for several years to practice in London as an astrologer, casting nativities, telling fortunes, and pointing out lucky and unlucky days. During the reign of Queen Mary, he got into trouble, being suspected of heresy, and charged with attempting Mary's life by means of enchantments. He was tried for the latter offense and acquitted, but was retained in prison on the former charge, and left to the tender mercies of Bishop Bonner. He had a very narrow escape from being burned in Smithfield, but he somehow or other contrived to persuade that fierce bigot that his orthodoxy was unimpeachable, and was set at liberty in 1555. On the accession of Elizabeth, a brighter day dawned upon him. During her retirement at Woodstock, her servants appear to have consulted him as to the time of Mary's death, which circumstance no doubt first gave rise to the serious charge for which he was brought to trial. They now came to consult him more openly as to the fortunes of their mistress, and Robert Dudley, the celebrated Earl of Leicester, was sent by command of the Queen herself to know the most auspicious day for her coronation. So great was the favor he enjoyed that some years afterwards, Elizabeth condescended to pay him a visit at his house in Mortlake to view his museum of curiosities, and when he was ill, sent her own physician to attend upon him. Astrology was the means whereby he lived, and he continued to practice it with great assiduity, but his heart was in alchemy. The philosopher's stone and the elixir of life haunted his daily thoughts and his nightly dreams. The Talmudic mysteries, which he had also deeply studied, impressed him with the belief that he might hold converse with spirits and angels, and learn from them all the mysteries of the universe. Holding the same idea as the then-obscure sect of the Rosicrucians, some of whom he had perhaps encountered in his travels in Germany, he imagined that by means of the philosopher's stone he could summon these kindly spirits at his will. By dint of continually brooding upon the subject, his imagination became so diseased that he at last persuaded himself that an angel appeared to him and promised to be his friend and companion as long as he lived. He relates that one day in November 1582, while he was engaged in fervent prayer, the window of his museum looking towards the west suddenly glowed with a dazzling light, in the midst of which, in all his glory, stood the great angel Uriel. Awe and wonder rendered him speechless, but the angel, smiling graciously upon him, gave him a crystal of a convex form, and told him that whenever he wished to hold converse with the beings of another sphere, he had only to gaze intently upon it, and they would appear in the crystal, and unveil to him all the secrets of futurity. Thus saying, the angel disappeared. The crystal alluded to appears to have been a black stone or piece of polished coal. The following account of it is given in the supplement to Granger's Biographical History. The black stone into which Dee used to call his spirits was in the collection of the Earls of Peterborough, from whence it came to Lady Elizabeth Germain. It was next the property of the late Duke of Argyle, and is now Mr. Walpole's. It appears upon examination to be nothing more than a polished piece of cannel coal, but this is what Butler means when he says, Kelly did all his feats upon the devil's looking-glass, a stone. Dee found from experience of the crystal that it was necessary that all the faculties of the soul should be concentrated upon it. Otherwise, the spirits did not appear. He also found that he could never recollect the conversations he had with the angels. He therefore determined to communicate the secret to another person, who might converse with the spirit while he, Dee, sat in another part of the room and took down in writing the revelations which they made. He had at this time in his service as his assistant one Edward Kelly, who, like himself, was crazy upon the subject of the philosopher's stone. There was this difference, however, between them, that while Dee was more of an enthusiast than an impostor, Kelly was more of an impostor than an enthusiast. In early life he was a notary and had the misfortune to lose both his ears for forgery. This mutilation, degrading enough in any man, was destructive to a philosopher. Kelly, therefore, lest his wisdom should suffer in the world's opinion, wore a black skull cap, which, fitting close to his head and descending over both his cheeks, not only concealed his loss, but gave him a very solemn and oracular appearance. So well did he keep his secret that even Dee, with whom he lived so many years, appears never to have discovered it. Kelly, with this character, was just the man to carry on any piece of roguery for his own advantage, or to nurture the delusions of his master for the same purpose. No sooner did Dee inform him of the visit he had received from the glorious Uriel than Kelly expressed such a fervor of belief that Dee's heart glowed with delight. He set about consulting his crystal forthwith, and on the 2nd of December 1581, the spirits appeared and held a very extraordinary discourse with Kelly, which Dee took down in writing. The curious reader may see this farrago of nonsense among the Harleian manuscripts in the British Museum. The later consultations were published in a folio volume in 1659 by Dr. Merrick Casaubon under the title of A True and Faithful Relation of What Passed Between Dr. John Dee and Some Spirits, tending had it succeeded to a general alteration of most states and kingdoms in the world. Lilly, the astrologer, in his Life, written by himself, frequently tells of prophecies delivered by the angels in a manner similar to the angels of Dr. Dee. He says, the prophecies were not given vocally by the angels, but by inspection of the crystal in types and figures, or by apparition, the circular way, where at some distance the angels appear, representing by forms, shapes, and creatures what is demanded. It is very rare, yea, even in our days, quoth that wiseacre, for any operator or master to hear the angels speak articulately. When they do speak, it is, like the Irish, much in the throat. The fame of these wondrous colloquies soon spread over the country, and even reached the continent. Dee, at the same time, pretended to be in possession of the elixir vitae, which he stated he had found among the ruins of Glastonbury Abbey, in Somersetshire. People flocked from far and near to his house at Mortlake to have their nativities cast, in preference to visiting astrologers of less renown. They also longed to see a man who, according to his own account, would never die. Altogether, he carried on a very profitable trade, but spent so much in drugs and metals to work out some peculiar process of transmutation that he never became rich. About this time there came into England a wealthy Polish nobleman named Albert Laski, Count Palatine of Shiraz. His object was principally, he said, to visit the court of Queen Elizabeth, the fame of whose glory and magnificence had reached him in distant Poland. Elizabeth received this flattering stranger with the most splendid hospitality and appointed her favorite, Leicester, to show him all that was worth seeing in England. He visited all the curiosities of London and Westminster, and from thence proceeded to Oxford and Cambridge, that he might converse with some of the great scholars whose writings shed luster upon the land of their birth. He was very much disappointed at not finding Dr. Dee among them, and told the Earl of Leicester that he would not have gone to Oxford if he had known that Dee was not there. The Earl promised to introduce him to the great alchemist on their return to London, and the Pole was satisfied. A few days afterwards, the Earl and Lasky being in the antechamber of the Queen awaiting an audience of Her Majesty, Dr. Dee arrived on the same errand and was introduced to the Pole. An interesting conversation ensued, which ended by the stranger inviting himself to dine with the astrologer at his house at Mortlake. Dee returned home in some tribulation, for he found he had not money enough, without pawning his plate, to entertain Count Lasky and his retinue in a manner becoming their dignity. In this emergency he sent off an express to the Earl of Leicester, stating frankly the embarrassment he labored under, and praying his good offices in representing the matter to Her Majesty. Elizabeth immediately sent him a present of £20. On the appointed day Count Lasky came, attended by a numerous retinue, and expressed such open and warm admiration of the wonderful attainments of his host, that Dee turned over in his own mind how he could bind irretrievably to his interests a man who seemed so well inclined to become his friend. Long acquaintance with Kelly had imbued him with all the roguery of that personage, and he resolved to make the Pole pay dearly for his dinner. He found out before many days that he possessed great estates in his own country, as well as great influence, but that an extravagant disposition had reduced him to temporary embarrassment. He also discovered that he was a firm believer in the philosopher's stone and the water of life. He was therefore just the man upon whom an adventurer might fasten himself. Kelly thought so too, and both of them set to work to weave a web, in the meshes of which they might firmly entangle the rich and credulous stranger. They went very cautiously about it, first throwing out obscure hints of the stone and the elixir, and finally of the spirits, by means of whom they could turn over the pages of the Book of Futurity and read the awful secrets inscribed therein. Lasky eagerly implored that he might be admitted to one of their mysterious interviews with Uriel and the angels, but they knew human nature too well to accede at once to the request. To the Count's entreaties they only replied by hints of the difficulty or impropriety of summoning the spirits in the presence of a stranger, or of one who might perchance have no other motive than the gratification of a vain curiosity. But they only meant to whet the edge of his appetite by this delay, and would have been sorry indeed if the Count had been discouraged. To show how exclusively the thoughts of both Dee and Kelly were fixed upon their dupe at this time, it is only necessary to read the introduction to their first interview with the spirits related in the volume of Dr. Casaubon. The entry made by Dee under the date of the 25th of May, 1583, says that when the spirit appeared to them, I, John Dee, and E.K., Edward Kelly, sat together conversing of that noble Polonian Albertus Lasky, his great honor here with us obtained, and of his great liking among all sorts of the people. No doubt they were discussing how they might make the most of the noble Polonian, and concocting the fine story with which they afterwards excited his curiosity and drew him firmly within their toils. Suddenly, says Dee, as they were thus employed, there seemed to come out of the oratory a spiritual creature, like a pretty girl of 7 or 9 years of age, attired on her head, with her hair rolled up before and hanging down behind, with a gown of silk of changeable red and green, and with a train. She seemed to play up and down and seemed to go in and out behind the books, and as she seemed to go between them, the books displaced themselves and made way for her. With such tales as these they lured on the Pole from day to day, and at last persuaded him to be a witness of their mysteries. Whether they played off any optical delusions upon him, or whether by the force of a strong imagination he deluded himself, does not appear, but certain it is that he became a complete tool in their hands, and consented to do whatever they wished him. Kelly, at these interviews, placed himself at a certain distance from the wondrous crystal, and gazed intently upon it, while Dee took his place in a corner, ready to set down the prophecies as they were uttered by the spirits. In this manner they prophesied to the Pole that he should become the fortunate possessor of the philosopher's stone, that he should live for centuries, and be chosen king of Poland, in which capacity he should gain many great victories over the Saracens, and make his name illustrious over all the earth. For this purpose it was necessary, however, that Lasky should leave England and take them with him, together with their wives and families, that he should treat them all sumptuously and allow them to want for nothing. Lasky at once consented, and very shortly afterwards they were all on the road to Poland. It took them upwards of 4 months to reach the Count's estates in the neighborhood of Krakow. In the meantime, they led a pleasant life and spent money with an unsparing hand. When once established in the Count's palace, they commenced the great hermetic operation of transmuting iron into gold. Lasky provided them with all necessary materials and aided them himself with his knowledge of alchemy, but somehow or other the experiment always failed at the very moment it ought to have succeeded, and they were obliged to recommence operations on a grander scale. But the hopes of Lasky were not easily extinguished. Already, in idea, the possessor of countless millions, he was not to be cast down for fear of present expenses. He thus continued from day to day and from month to month, until he was at last obliged to sell a portion of his deeply mortgaged estates to find aliment for the hungry crucibles of Dee and Kelly, and the no less hungry stomachs of their wives and families. It was not till ruin stared him in the face that he awoke from his dream of infatuation, too happy even then to find that he had escaped utter beggary. Thus restored to his senses, his first thought was how to rid himself of his expensive visitors. Not wishing to quarrel with them, he proposed that they should proceed to Prague, well furnished with letters of recommendation to the Emperor Rudolf. Our alchemists too plainly saw that nothing more was to be made of the almost destitute Count Lasky. Without hesitation, therefore, they accepted the proposal and set out forthwith to the imperial residence. They had no difficulty on their arrival at Prague in obtaining an audience of the emperor. They found him willing enough to believe that such a thing as the philosopher's stone existed, and flattered themselves that they had made a favorable impression upon him. But for some cause or other, perhaps the look of low cunning and quackery upon the face of Kelly, the emperor conceived no very high opinion of their abilities. He allowed them, however, to remain for some months at Prague, feeding themselves upon the hope that he would employ them. But the more he saw of them, the less he liked them. And when the Pope's nuncio represented to him that he ought not to countenance such heretic magicians, he gave orders that they should quit his dominions within 24 hours. It was fortunate for them that so little time was given them, for had they remained 6 hours longer, the nuncio had received orders to procure a perpetual dungeon or the stake for them. Not knowing well whither to direct their steps, they resolved to return to Krakow, where they had still a few friends, but by this time the funds they had drawn from Lasky were almost exhausted, and they were many days obliged to go dinnerless and supperless. They had great difficulty to keep their poverty a secret from the world, but they managed to bear privation without murmuring, from a conviction that if the fact were known it would militate very much against their pretensions. Nobody would believe that they were possessors of the philosopher's stone if it were once suspected that they did not know how to procure bread for their subsistence. They still gained a little by casting nativities, and kept starvation at arm's length till a new dupe, rich enough for their purposes, dropped into their toils in the shape of a royal personage. Having procured an introduction to Stephen, King of Poland, they predicted to him that the Emperor Rudolf would shortly be assassinated, and that the Germans would look to Poland for his successor. As this prediction was not precise enough to satisfy the king, they tried their crystal again, and a spirit appeared who told them that the new sovereign of Germany would be Stephen of Poland. Stephen was credulous enough to believe them, and was once present when Kelly held his mystic conversations with the shadows of his crystal. He also appears to have furnished them with money to carry on their experiments in alchemy. But he grew tired at last of their broken promises and their constant drains upon his pocket, and was on the point of discarding them with disgrace when they met with another dupe, to whom they eagerly transferred their services. This was Count Rosenberg, a nobleman of large estates at Trebona in Bohemia. So comfortable did they find themselves in the palace of this munificent patron that they remained nearly 4 years with him, faring sumptuously, and having an almost unlimited command of his money. The Count was more ambitious than avaricious, He had wealth enough and did not care for the philosopher's stone on account of the gold, but of the length of days it would bring him. They had their predictions accordingly already framed to suit his character. They prophesied that he should be chosen king of Poland, and promised, moreover, that he should live for 500 years to enjoy his dignity, provided always that he found them sufficient money to carry on their experiments. But now, while fortune smiled upon them, while they reveled in the rewards of successful villainy, retributive justice came upon them in a shape they had not anticipated. Jealousy and mistrust sprang up between the two confederates and led to such violent and frequent quarrels that Dee was in constant fear of exposure. Kelly imagined himself a much greater personage than Dee, measuring, most likely, by the standard of impudent roguery, and was displeased that on all occasions and from all persons, Dee received the greater share of honor and consideration. He often threatened to leave Dee to shift for himself, and the latter, who had degenerated into the mere tool of his more daring associate, was distressed beyond measure at the prospect of his desertion. His mind was so deeply imbued with superstition that he believed the rhapsodies of Kelly to be, in a great measure, derived from his intercourse with angels, and he knew not where in the whole world to look for a man of depth and wisdom enough to succeed him. As their quarrels every day became more and more frequent, Dee wrote letters to Queen Elizabeth to secure a favorable reception on his return to England, whither he intended to proceed if Kelly forsook him. He also sent her a round piece of silver, which he pretended he had made of a portion of brass cut out of a warming pan. He afterwards sent her the warming pan also, that she might convince herself that the piece of silver corresponded exactly with the hole which was cut into the brass. While thus preparing for the worst, his chief desire was to remain in Bohemia with Count Rosenberg, who treated him well and reposed much confidence in him. Neither had Kelly any great objection to remain, but a new passion had taken possession of his breast, and he was laying deep schemes to gratify it. His own wife was ill-favored and ill-natured. Dee's was comely and agreeable, and he longed to make an exchange of partners without exciting the jealousy or shocking the morality of Dee. This was a difficult matter, but to a man like Kelly, who was as deficient in rectitude and right feeling as he was full of impudence and ingenuity, the difficulty was not insurmountable. He had also deeply studied the character and the foibles of Dee, and he took his measures accordingly. The next time they consulted the spirits, Kelly pretended to be shocked at their language, and refused to tell Dee what they had said. Dee insisted and was informed that they were henceforth to have their wives in common. Dee, a little startled, inquired whether the spirits might not mean that they were to live in common harmony and goodwill. Kelly tried again, with apparent reluctance, and said the spirits insisted upon the literal interpretation. The poor fanatic Dee resigned himself to their will, but it suited Kelly's purpose to appear coy a little longer. He declared that the spirits must be spirits not of good, but of evil, and refused to consult them any more. He thereupon took his departure, saying that he would never return. Dee, thus left to himself, was in sore trouble and distress of mind. He knew not on whom to fix as the successor to Kelly for consulting the spirits, but at last chose his son Arthur, a boy of 8 years of age. He consecrated him to this service with great ceremony and impressed upon the child's mind the dignified and awful nature of the duties he was called upon to perform. But the poor boy had neither the imagination, the faith, nor the artifice of Kelly. He looked intently upon the crystal, as he was told, but could see nothing and hear nothing. At last, when his eyes ached, he said he could see a vague, indistinct shadow, but nothing more. Dee was in despair. The deception had been carried on so long that he was never so happy as when he fancied he was holding converse with superior beings. And he cursed the day that had put estrangement between him and his dear friend Kelly. This was exactly what Kelly had foreseen, and when he thought the doctor had grieved sufficiently for his absence, he returned unexpectedly and entered the room where the little Arthur was in vain endeavoring to distinguish something in the crystal. Dee, in entering this circumstance in his journal, ascribes this sudden return to a miraculous fortune and a divine fate, and goes on to record that Kelly immediately saw the spirits which had remained invisible to little Arthur. One of these spirits reiterated the previous command, that they should have their wives in common. Kelly bowed his head and submitted, and Dee, in all humility, consented to the arrangement. This was the extreme depth of the wretched man's degradation. In this manner they continued to live for 3 or 4 months, when, new quarrels breaking out, they separated once more. This time their separation was final. Kelly, taking the elixir which he had found in Glastonbury Abbey, proceeded to Prague, forgetful of the abrupt mode in which he had previously been expelled from that city. Almost immediately after his arrival, he was seized by order of the Emperor Rudolf and thrown into prison. He was released after some months' confinement and continued for 5 years to lead a vagabond life in Germany, telling fortunes at one place and pretending to make gold at another. He was a second time thrown into prison on a charge of heresy and sorcery. And he then resolved, if ever he obtained his liberty, to return to England. He soon discovered that there was no prospect of this, and that his imprisonment was likely to be for life. He twisted his bedclothes into a rope one stormy night in February 1595 and let himself down from the window of his dungeon, situated at the top of a very high tower. Being a corpulent man, the rope gave way, and he was precipitated to the ground. He broke 2 of his ribs and both his legs, and was otherwise so much injured that he expired a few days afterwards. Dee, for a while, had more prosperous fortune. The warming pan he had sent to Queen Elizabeth was not without effect. He was rewarded soon after Kelly had left him with an invitation to return to England. His pride, which had been sorely humbled, sprang up again to its pristine dimensions, and he set out from Bohemia with a train of attendants, becoming an ambassador. How he procured the money does not appear, unless from the liberality of the rich Bohemian Rosenberg, or perhaps from his plunder. He traveled with 3 coaches for himself and his family, and 3 wagons to carry his baggage. Each coach had 4 horses, and the whole train was protected by a guard of 24 soldiers. This statement may be doubted, but it is on the authority of Dee himself, who made it on oath before the commissioners appointed by Elizabeth to inquire into his circumstances. On his arrival in England, he had an audience of the Queen, who received him kindly as far as words went, and gave orders that he should not be molested in his pursuits of chemistry and philosophy. A man who boasted of the power to turn baser metals into gold could not, thought Elizabeth, be in want of money, and she therefore gave him no more substantial marks of her approbation than her countenance and protection. Thrown thus unexpectedly upon his own resources, Dee began in earnest the search for the philosopher's stone. He worked incessantly among his furnaces, retorts, and crucibles, and almost poisoned himself with deleterious fumes. He also consulted his miraculous crystal, but the spirits appeared not to him. He tried one Bartholomew to supply the place of the invaluable Kelly, but he being a man of some little probity and of no imagination at all, the spirits would not hold any communication with him. Dee then tried another pretender to philosophy of the name of Hickman, but had no better fortune. The crystal had lost its power since the departure of its great high priest. From this quarter, then, Dee could get no information on the stone or elixir of the alchemists, and all his efforts to discover them by other means were not only fruitless but expensive. He was soon reduced to great distress and wrote piteous letters to the Queen, praying relief. He represented that after he left England with Count Lasky, the mob had pillaged his house at Mortlake, accusing him of being a necromancer and a wizard, and had broken all his furniture, burned his library, consisting of 4,000 rare volumes, and destroyed all the philosophical instruments and curiosities in his museum. For this damage he claimed compensation, and furthermore stated that as he had come to England by the Queen's command, she ought to pay the expenses of his journey. Elizabeth sent him small sums of money at various times, but Dee still continuing his complaints, a commission was appointed to inquire into his circumstances. He finally obtained a small appointment as Chancellor of St. Paul's Cathedral, which he exchanged in 1595 for the wardenship of the college at Manchester. He remained in this capacity till 1602 or 1603, when, his strength and intellect beginning to fail him, he was compelled to resign. He retired to his old dwelling at Mortlake, an estate not far removed from actual want, supporting himself as a common fortune teller and being often obliged to sell or pawn his books to procure a dinner. James I was often applied to on his behalf, but he refused to do anything for him. It may be said to the discredit of this king that the only reward he would grant the indefatigable Stow in his days of old age and want was the royal permission to beg, but no one will blame him for neglecting such a quack as John Dee. He died in 1608 in the 81st year of his age and was buried at Mortlake. The Cosmopolite. Many disputes have arisen as to the real name of the alchemist who wrote several works under the above designation. The general opinion is that he was a Scotsman named Seton, and that by a fate very common to alchemists who boasted too loudly of their powers of transmutation, he ended his days miserably in a dungeon into which he was thrown by a German potentate until he made a million of gold to pay his ransom. By some, he has been confounded with Michael Sendivog, or Sendivogius, a Pole, a professor of the same art, who made a great noise in Europe at the commencement of the 17th century. Longley Dufresnoy, who is in general well informed with respect to the alchemists, inclines to the belief that these personages were distinct, and gives the following particulars of the Cosmopolite, extracted from George Morhoff in his Epistula ad Longelotum, and other writers. About the year 1600, one Jacob Housen, a Dutch pilot, was shipwrecked on the coast of Scotland. A gentleman named Alexander Seton put off in a boat and saved him from drowning, and afterwards entertained him hospitably for many weeks at his house on the shore. Housen saw that he was addicted to the pursuits of chemistry, but no conversation on the subject passed between them at the time. About a year and a half afterwards, Housen, being then at home at Enkhuizen in Holland, received a visit from his former host. He endeavored to repay the kindness that had been shown him, and so great a friendship arose between them that Seton, on his departure, offered to make him acquainted with the great secret of the philosopher's stone. In his presence, the Scotsman transmuted a great quantity of base metal into pure gold, and gave it him as a mark of his esteem. Seton then took leave of his friend and traveled into Germany. At Dresden he made no secret of his wonderful powers, having, it is said, performed transmutation successfully before a great assemblage of the learned men of that city. The circumstances coming to the ears of the Duke or Elector of Saxony, he gave orders for the arrest of the alchemist. He caused him to be imprisoned in a high tower and set a guard of 40 men to watch that he did not escape, and that no strangers were admitted to his presence. The unfortunate Seton received several visits from the Elector, who used every art of persuasion to make him divulge his secret. Seton obstinately refused either to communicate his secret or to make any gold for the tyrant, on which he was stretched upon the rack to see if the argument of torture would render him more tractable. The result was still the same. Neither hope of reward nor fear of anguish could shake him. For several months he remained in prison, subjected alternately to a sedative and a violent regimen, till his health broke and he wasted away almost to a skeleton. There happened at that time to be in Dresden a learned Pole named Michael Sendivogius, who had wasted a good deal of his time and substance in the unprofitable pursuits of alchemy. He was touched with pity for the hard fate and admiration for the intrepidity of Seton, and determined, if possible, to aid him in escaping from the clutch of his oppressor. He requested the Elector's permission to see the alchemist, and obtained it with some difficulty. He found him in a state of great wretchedness, shut up from the light of day in a noisome dungeon, with no better couch or fare than those allotted to the worst of criminals. Seton listened eagerly to the proposal of escape, and promised the generous Pole that he would make him richer than an Eastern monarch if by his means he were liberated. Sendivogius immediately commenced operations. He sold some property which he possessed near Krakow, and with the proceeds led a merry life at Dresden. He gave the most elegant suppers, to which he regularly invited the officers of the guard, and especially those who did duty at the prison of the alchemist. He insinuated himself at last into their confidence, and obtained free ingress to his friend as often as he pleased, pretending that he was using his utmost endeavors to conquer his obstinacy and worm his secret out of him. When their project was ripe, a day was fixed upon for the grand attempt, and Sendivogius was ready at a post-chariot to convey him with all speed into Poland. By drugging some wine which he presented to the guards of the prison, he rendered them so drowsy that he easily found means to scale a wall unobserved with Seton and effect his escape. Seton's wife was in the chariot awaiting him, having safely in her possession a small packet of a black powder, which was, in fact, the philosopher's stone, or ingredient for the transmutation of iron and copper into gold. They all arrived in safety at Krakow, but the frame of Seton was so wasted by torture of body and starvation, to say nothing of the anguish of mind he had endured, that he did not long survive. He died in Krakow in 1603 or 1604, and was buried under the cathedral church of that city. Such is the story related of the author of the various works which bear the name of the Cosmopolite. A list of them may be found in the third volume of the History of the Hermetic Philosophy. Sendivogius. On the death of Seton, Sendivogius married his widow, hoping to learn from her some of the secrets of her deceased lord in the art of transmutation. The ounce of black powder stood him, however, in better service, for the alchemists say that by its means he converted great quantities of quicksilver into the purest gold. It is also said that he performed this experiment successfully before the Emperor Rudolf II at Prague, and that the Emperor, to commemorate the circumstance, caused a marble tablet to be affixed to the wall of the room in which it was performed, bearing this inscription: "Faciat hoc quispiam alius, quod fecit Sendivogius Polonus." Monsieur de Noyer, secretary to the Princess Mary of Gonzaga, Queen of Poland, writing from Warsaw in 1651, says that he saw this tablet, which existed at that time, and was often visited by the curious. The afterlife of Sendivogius is related in a Latin memoir of him by one Bradovsky, his steward, and is inserted by Pierre Borel in his Treasure of Gaulish Antiquities. The Emperor Rudolf, according to this authority, was so well pleased with his success that he made him one of his counselors of state, and invited him to fill a station in the royal household and inhabit the palace. But Sendivogius loved his liberty and refused to become a courtier. He preferred to reside in his own patrimonial estate of Gravarna, where for many years he exercised a princely hospitality. His philosophic powder, which his steward says was red and not black, he kept in a little box of gold, and with one grain of it he could make 500 ducats or 1,000 rix dollars. He generally made his projection upon quicksilver. When he traveled, he gave this box to his steward, who hung it round his neck by a gold chain next his skin. But the greatest part of the powder he used to hide in a secret place cut into the step of his chariot. He thought that if attacked at any time by robbers, they would not search such a place as that. When he anticipated any danger, he would dress himself in his valet's clothes and, mounting the coach box, put the valet inside. He was induced to take these precautions because it was no secret that he possessed the philosopher's stone, and many unprincipled adventurers were on the watch for an opportunity to plunder him. A German prince, whose name Bradovsky has not thought fit to chronicle, served him a scurvy trick, which ever afterwards put him on his guard. This prince went on his knees to Sendivogius and entreated him in the most pressing terms to satisfy his curiosity by converting some quicksilver into gold before him. Sendivogius, wearied by his importunity, consented, upon a promise of inviolable secrecy. After his departure, the prince called a German alchemist named Mühlenfels, who resided in his house, and told him all that had been done. Mühlenfels entreated that he might have a dozen mounted horsemen at his command, that he might instantly ride after the philosopher and either rob him of all his powder or force from him the secret of making it. The prince desired nothing better. Mühlenfels, being provided with 12 men well mounted and armed, pursued Sendivogius in hot haste. He came up with him at a lonely inn by the roadside, just as he was sitting down to dinner. He at first endeavored to persuade him to divulge the secret, but finding this of no avail, he caused his accomplices to strip the unfortunate Sendivogius and tie him naked to one of the pillars of the house. He then took from him his golden box containing a small quantity of the powder, a manuscript book on the Philosopher's Stone, a golden medal with its chain presented to him by the Emperor Rudolf, and a rich cap ornamented with diamonds of the value of 100,000 rix dollars. With this booty he decamped, leaving Sendivogius still naked and firmly bound to the pillar. His servants had been treated in a similar manner, but the people of the inn released them all as soon as the robbers were out of sight. Sendivogius proceeded to Prague and made his complaint to the emperor. An express was instantly sent off to the prince with orders that he should deliver up Mühlenfels and all his plunder. The prince, fearful of the emperor's wrath, caused three large gallows to be erected in his courtyard, on the highest of which he hanged Mühlenfels, with another thief on each side of him. He thus propitiated the emperor and got rid of an ugly witness against himself. He sent back at the same time the bejeweled hat, the medal and chain, and the treatise upon the Philosopher's Stone, which had been stolen from Sendivogius. As regarded the powder, he said he had not seen it and knew nothing about it. This adventure made Sendivogius more prudent. He would no longer perform the process of transmutation before any strangers, however highly recommended. He pretended also to be very poor, and sometimes lay in bed for weeks together, that people might believe he was suffering from some dangerous malady, and could not therefore by any possibility be the owner of the Philosopher's Stone. He would occasionally coin false money and pass it off as gold, preferring to be esteemed a cheat rather than a successful alchemist. Many other extraordinary tales are told of this personage by his steward, Brodowski, but they are not worth repeating. He died in 1636, aged upwards of 80, and was buried in his own chapel at Gravarna. Several works upon alchemy have been published under his name. The Rosicrucians. It was during the time of the last mentioned author that the sect of the Rosicrucians first began to create a sensation in Europe. The influence which they exercised upon opinion during their brief career, and the permanent impression which they have left upon European literature, claim for them a special notice. Before their time, alchemy was but a groveling delusion, and theirs is the merit of having spiritualized and refined it. They also enlarged its sphere, and supposed the possession of the Philosopher's Stone to be not only the means of wealth, but of health and happiness, and the instrument by which man could command the services of superior beings, control the elements to his will, defy the obstructions of time and space, and acquire the most intimate knowledge of all the secrets of the universe. Wild and visionary as they were not without their uses. If it were only for having purged the superstitions of Europe of the dark and disgusting forms with which the monks had peopled it, and substituted in their stead a race of mild, graceful, and beneficent beings. They are said to have derived their name from Christian Rosenkreutz, or Rose Cross, a German philosopher who traveled in the Holy Land towards the close of the 14th century. While dangerously ill at a place called Damkar, he was visited by some learned Arabs, who claimed him as their brother in science, and unfolded to him by inspiration all the secrets of his past life, both of thought and of action. They restored him to health by means of the Philosopher's Stone, and afterwards instructed him in all their mysteries. He returned to Europe in 1401, being then only 23 years of age, and drew a chosen number of his friends around him, whom he initiated into the new science and bound by solemn oaths to keep it secret for a century. He is said to have lived 83 years after this period, and to have died in 1484. Many have denied the existence of such a personage as Rosenkreutz, and have fixed the origin of this sect at a much later epoch. The first dawning of it, they say, is to be found in the theories of Paracelsus and the dreams of Dr. Dee, who, without intending it, became the actual, though never the recognized, founders of the Rosicrucian philosophy. It is now difficult, and indeed impossible, to determine whether Dee and Paracelsus obtained their ideas from the then obscure and unknown Rosicrucians, or whether the Rosicrucians did but follow and improve upon them. Certain it is that their existence was never suspected till the year 1605, when they began to excite attention in Germany. No sooner were their doctrines promulgated than all the visionaries, Paracelsists, and alchemists flocked around their standard and vaunted Rosenkreuz as the new regenerator of the human race. Michael Meyer, a celebrated physician of that day and who had impaired his health and wasted his fortune in searching for the philosopher's stone, drew up a report of the tenets and ordinances of the new fraternity, which was published at Cologne in the year 1615. They asserted, in the first place, that the meditations of their founders surpassed everything that had ever been imagined since the creation of the world, without even accepting the revelations of the deity, that they were destined to accomplish the general peace and regeneration of man before the end of the world arrived, that they possessed all wisdom and piety in a supreme degree, that they possessed all the graces of nature and could distribute them among the rest of mankind according to their pleasure, that they were subject to neither hunger, nor thirst, nor disease, nor old age, nor to any other inconvenience of nature, that they knew by inspiration and at the first glance everyone who was worthy to be admitted into their society, that they had the same knowledge then which they would have possessed if they had lived from the beginning of the world, and had been always acquiring it, that they had a volume in which they could read all that ever was or ever would be written in other books till the end of time, that they could force to and retain in their service the most powerful spirits and demons, that by virtue of their songs they could attract pearls and precious stones from the depths of the sea or the bowels of the earth, that God had covered them with a thick cloud, by means of which they could shelter themselves from the malignity of their enemies, and that they could thus render themselves invisible from all eyes, that the first eight brethren of the Rose Cross had power to cure all maladies, that by means of the fraternity the tripled diadem of the Pope would be reduced into dust, that they only admitted two sacraments with the ceremonies of the primitive church renewed by them, that they recognized the fourth monarchy and the emperor of the Romans as their chief and the chief of all Christians, that they would provide him with more gold, their treasures being inexhaustible, than the king of Spain had ever drawn from the golden regions of eastern and western Ind. This was their confession of faith. Their rules of conduct were six in number and as follow. First, that in their travels they should gratuitously cure all diseases. Second, that they should always dress in conformity to the fashion of the country in which they resided. Thirdly, that they should, once every year, meet together in the place appointed by the fraternity, or send in writing an available excuse. Fourthly, that every brother, whenever he felt inclined to die, should choose a person worthy to succeed him. Fifthly, that the words Rose Cross should be the marks by which they should recognize each other. Sixthly, that their fraternity should be kept secret for 6 times 20 years. They asserted that these laws had been found inscribed in a golden book in the tomb of Rosenkreuz, and that the 6 times 20 years from his death expired in 1604. They were consequently called upon from that time forth to promulgate their doctrine for the welfare of mankind. The following legend of the tomb of Rosenkreuz, written by Eustace Budgell, appears in number 379 of The Spectator. A certain person, having occasion to dig somewhat deep in the ground where this philosopher lay interred, met with a small door having a wall on each side of it. His curiosity and the hope of finding some hidden treasure soon prompted him to force open the door. He was immediately surprised by a sudden blaze of light and discovered a very fair vault. At the upper end of it was a statue of a man in armor sitting by a table and leaning on his left arm. He held a truncheon in his right hand and had a lamp burning before him. The man had no sooner set one foot within the vault than the statue, erecting itself from its leaning posture, stood bolt upright, and upon the fellow's advancing another step, lifted up the truncheon in his right hand. The man still ventured a third step, when the statue, with a furious blow, broke the lamp into a thousand pieces and left his guest in sudden darkness. Upon the report of this adventure, the country people came with lights to the sepulchre and discovered that the statue, which was made of brass, was nothing more than a piece of clockwork, that the floor of the vault was all loose and underlaid with several springs, which, upon any man's entering, naturally produced that which had happened. Rosicrucius, say his disciples, made use of this method to show the world that he had reinvented the ever-burning lamps of the ancients, though he was resolved no one should reap any advantage from the discovery. For 8 years, these enthusiasts made converts in Germany, but they excited little or no attention in other parts of Europe. At last they made their appearance in Paris and threw all the learned, all the credulous, and all the lovers of the marvelous into commotion. In the beginning of March 1623, the good folks of that city, when they arose one morning, were surprised to find all their walls placarded with the following singular manifesto. "We, the deputies of the principal college of the Brethren of the Rose Cross, have taken up our abode, visible and invisible, in this city, by the grace of the Most High, towards whom are turned the hearts of the just. We show and teach without books or signs, and speak all sorts of languages in the countries where we dwell, to draw mankind, our fellows, from error and from death." For a long time, this strange placard was the sole topic of conversation in all public places. Some few wondered, but the greater number only laughed at it. In the course of a few weeks, two books were published, which raised the first alarm respecting this mysterious society, whose dwelling place no one knew, and no members of which had ever been seen. The first was called A History of the Frightful Compacts Entered Into Between the Devil and the Pretended Invisibles, with Their Damnable Instructions, the Deplorable Ruin of Their Disciples, and Their Miserable End. The other was called An Examination of the New and Unknown Kabbalah of the Brethren of the Rose Cross, who have lately inhabited the city of Paris, with the history of their manners, the wonders worked by them, and many other particulars. These books sold rapidly. Everyone was anxious to know something of this dreadful and secret brotherhood. The badauds of Paris were so alarmed that they daily expected to see the archenemy walking in propria persona among them. It was said in these volumes that the Rosicrucian Society consisted of 36 persons in all, who had renounced their baptism and hope of resurrection. That it was not by means of good angels, as they pretended, that they worked their prodigies, but that it was the devil who gave them power to transport themselves from one end of the world to the other with the rapidity of thought, to speak all languages, to have their purses always full of money, however much they might spend, to be invisible and penetrate into the most secret places in spite of fastenings of bolts and bars, and to be able to tell the past and future. These 36 brethren were divided into bands or companies. 6 of them only had been sent on the mission to Paris, 6 to Italy, 6 to Spain, 6 to Germany, 4 to Sweden, and 2 into Switzerland, 2 into Flanders, 2 into Lorraine, and 2 into Franche-Comté. It was generally believed that the missionaries to France resided somewhere in the Marais du Temple. That quarter of Paris soon acquired a bad name, and people were afraid to take houses in it, lest they should be turned out by the 6 invisibles of the Rose Cross. It was believed by the populace, and by many others whose education should have taught them better, that persons of a mysterious aspect used to visit the inns and hotels of Paris, and eat of the best meats and drink of the best wines, and then suddenly melt away into thin air when the landlord came with the reckoning. The gentle maidens who went to bed alone often awoke in the night and found men in bed with them, of shape more beautiful than the Grecian Apollo, who immediately became invisible when an alarm was raised. It was also said that many persons found large heaps of gold in their houses without knowing from whence they came. All Paris was in alarm. No man thought himself secure of his goods, no maiden of her virginity or wife of her chastity, while these Rosicrucians were abroad. In the midst of the commotion, a second placard was issued to the following effect. If anyone desires to see the Brethren of the Rose Cross from curiosity only, he will never communicate with us. But if his will really induces him to inscribe his name in the register of our brotherhood, we, who can judge of the thoughts of all men, will convince him of the truth of our promises. For this reason we do not publish to the world the place of our abode. Thought alone, in unison with the sincere will of those who desire to know us, is sufficient to make us known to them and them to us. Though the existence of such a society as that of the Rose Cross was problematical, it was quite evident that somebody or other was concerned in the promulgation of these placards, which were stuck up on every wall in Paris. The police endeavored in vain to find out the offenders, and their want of success only served to increase the perplexity of the public. The church very soon took up the question, and the Abbé Gautier, a Jesuit, wrote a book to prove that by their enmity to the Pope, they could be no other than disciples of Luther, sent to promulgate his heresy. Their very name, he added, proved that they were heretics. A cross surmounted by a rose being the heraldic device of the arch-heretic Luther. One Garras said they were a confraternity of drunken impostors, and that their name was derived from the garland of roses in the form of a cross hung over the tables of taverns in Germany as the emblem of secrecy, and from whence was derived the common saying, when one man communicated a secret to another, that it was said under the rose. Others interpreted the letters FRC to mean not Brethren of the Rose Cross, but Fratres Roris Cocti, or Brothers of Boiled Dew, and explained this appellation by alleging that they collected large quantities of morning dew and boiled it in order to extract a very valuable ingredient in the composition of the Philosopher's Stone and the Water of Life. The fraternity thus attacked defended themselves as well as they were able. They denied that they used magic of any kind, or that they consulted the devil. They said they were all happy, that they had lived more than a century and expected to live many centuries more, and that the intimate knowledge which they possessed of all nature was communicated to them by God Himself as a reward for their piety and utter devotion to His service. Those were in error who derived their name from a cross of roses, or called them drunkards. To set the world right on the first point, they reiterated that they derived their name from Christian Rosenkreutz, their founder. And to answer the latter charge, they repeated that they knew not what thirst was, and had higher pleasures than those of the palate. They did not desire to meddle with the politics or religion of any man or set of men, although they could not help denying the supremacy of the Pope, and looking upon him as a tyrant. Many slanders, they said, had been repeated respecting them, the most unjust of which was that they indulged in carnal appetites, and under the cloak of their invisibility crept into the chambers of beautiful maidens. They asserted, on the contrary, that the first vow they took on entering the society was a vow of chastity, and that anyone among them who transgressed in that particular would immediately lose all the advantages he enjoyed, and be exposed once more to hunger, woe, disease, and death, like other men. So strongly did they feel on the subject of chastity that they attributed the fall of Adam solely to his want of this virtue. Besides defending themselves in this manner, they entered into a further confession of their faith. They discarded forever all the old tales of sorcery and witchcraft and communion with the devil. They said there were no such horrid, unnatural, and disgusting beings as the incubi and succubi, and the innumerable grotesque imps that men had believed in for so many ages. Man was not surrounded with enemies like these, but with myriads of beautiful and beneficent beings, all anxious to do him service. The air was peopled with sylphs, the water with undines or naiads, the bowels of the earth with gnomes, and the fire with salamanders. All these beings were the friends of man, and desired nothing so much as that men should purge themselves of all uncleanness, and thus be enabled to see and converse with them. They possessed great power, and were unrestrained by the barriers of space or the obstructions of matter. But man was in one particular their superior. He had an immortal soul, and they had not. They might, however, become sharers in man's immortality if they could inspire one of that race with the passion of love towards them. Hence it was the constant endeavor of the female spirits to captivate the admiration of men, and of the male gnomes, sylphs, salamanders, and undines, to be beloved by a woman. The object of this passion, in returning their love, imparted a portion of that celestial fire, the soul. And from that time forth, the beloved became equal to the lover, and both, when their allotted course was run, entered together into the mansions of felicity. These spirits, they said, watched constantly over mankind by night and day. Dreams, omens, and presentiments were all their works, and the means by which they gave warning of the approach of danger. But though so well inclined to befriend man for their own sakes, the want of a soul rendered them at times capricious and revengeful. They took offense on slight causes, and heaped injuries instead of benefits on the heads of those who extinguished the light of reason that was in them by gluttony, debauchery, and other appetites of the body. The excitement produced in Paris by the placards of the Brotherhood and the attacks of the clergy wore itself away after a few months. The stories circulated about them became at last too absurd, even for that age of absurdity, and men began to laugh once more at those invisible gentlemen and their fantastic doctrines. Gabriel Naudet, at that conjuncture, brought out his Avis à la France sur les Frères de la Rose Croix, in which he successfully exposed the folly of the new sect. This work, though not well written, was well timed. It quite extinguished the Rosicrucians of France, and after that year little more was heard of them. Swindlers in different parts of the country assumed the name at times to cloak their depredations, and now and then one of them was caught and hanged for his too great ingenuity in enticing pearls and precious stones from the pockets of other people into his own, or for passing off lumps of gilded brass for pure gold made by the agency of the philosopher's stone. With these exceptions, oblivion shrouded them. The doctrine was not confined to a sphere so narrow as France alone. It still nourished in Germany and drew many converts in England. The latter countries produced two great masters in the persons of Jakob Böhmen and Robert Fludd, pretended philosophers, of whom it is difficult to say which was the more absurd and extravagant. It would appear that the sect was divided into two classes, the brothers Rosii Crucis, who devoted themselves to the wonders of this sublunary sphere, and the brothers Aurei Crucis, who were wholly occupied in the contemplation of things divine. Fludd belonged to the first class, and Böhmen to the second. Fludd may be called the father of the English Rosicrucians, and as such merits a conspicuous niche in the Temple of Folly. He was born in the year 1574 at Millgate in Kent, and was the son of Sir Thomas Fludd, treasurer of war to Queen Elizabeth. He was originally intended for the army, but he was too fond of study and of a disposition too quiet and retiring to shine in that sphere. His father would not therefore press him to adopt a course of life for which he was unsuited, and encouraged him in the study of medicine, for which he early manifested a partiality. At the age of 25, he proceeded to the continent, and being fond of the abstruse, the marvelous, and the incomprehensible, he became an ardent disciple of the school of Paracelsus, whom he looked upon as the regenerator not only of medicine, but of philosophy. He remained 6 years in Italy, France, and Germany, storing his mind with fantastic notions, and seeking the society of enthusiasts and visionaries. On his return to England in 1605, he received the degree of Doctor of Medicine from the University of Oxford, and began to practice as a physician in London. He soon made himself conspicuous. He Latinized his name from Robert Fludd into Robertus Affluctibus, and began the promulgation of many strange doctrines. He avowed his belief in the philosopher's stone, the water of life, and the universal alkahest, and maintained that there were but two principles of all things, which were condensation, the boreal or northern virtue, and rarefaction, the southern or austral virtue. A number of demons, he said, ruled over the human frame, whom he arranged in their places in a rhomboid. Every disease had its particular demon who produced it, which demon could only be combated by the aid of the demon whose place was directly opposite to his in the rhomboidal figure. Of his medical notions we shall have further occasion to speak in another part of this book, when we consider him in his character as one of the first founders of the magnetic delusion, and its offshoot, animal magnetism,